events at culturedays.ca.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. When all ahead seemed dark as night, it witnessed many a deed and vow. We mustn't change its color now.
raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath your foes we'll live and die. No cowards flinch and traitor sneer. We'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumph's past. It gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, the symbol plain of human rights and human gain. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live or die. Though cowards flinch and traitor sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. His mind's affixed on pelf and place. The cringe beneath the rich man's frown and all that sacred emblem down. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. With heads uncovered, swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song should be our parting hymn. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
God created rich people first, and then showed them the world they would own. And when they came to a field with thousands of headless bodies, with torsos and hands like iron, God told them that the headless bodies were destined to be poor workers. The rich cried out, "But these heroes with their iron muscles will crush us, don't be frightened." Answered God, "I shall place very small heads and brains on their bodies, so until they develop them, you've nothing to fear." Who are still the oppressors? The rich. Who are still the oppressed? The poor. Your slavery is their liberty. Your poverty is their prosperity. Priests say the poor must be content with their poverty and they'll find heaven hereafter. Idiots. Cretinous rag pickers. My dog Georges has more sense. Don't you know that whilst you're gazing up at heaven, your pockets are being picked clean, your eyes are plucked out, and you're robbed of your birthright, blind to what is done to you? Christ's priests seized mankind in its cradle and broke the bad news, saying, "You shapeless stench, you can never be anything but filth. Your only chance of winning a pardon for being so filthy is if you bow low in perfect humility in the face of all the afflictions, sorrows, and injustices heaped upon you. You're poor, and you stay poor. That is how it is meant to be. Life is a bitter, bitter ordeal. Don't speak out. Just try and save your worthless soul. You won't be able to, but you'll give us less trouble by trying. And when the time comes for you to die, croaking, the darkness will be as hard to bear as the daylight ever was. The church knows its business. It offers fear and punishment, not happiness, certainly not liberty, only servitude, forever and forever. Religion is a liar and a cheat. Yet still you hunger for it. That's why you've sent for me, Jacques Roux, Mad Jacques, Red Roux, preacher of the poor, sower of sedition, subverter of all laws, a priest who saw the light of reason and now proclaims fellowship with all who live in dark dens and desolate places. It's fitting that I should preach perhaps my last sermon in a ruined church in the parish of St. Nicholas at Summer's End. I go before the tribunal tomorrow, charged with revolutionary excess. Now I am, it seems, too revolutionary for the revolution, and so it begins. When power rested in one man, King Louis, all sorts complained of oppression, and the nobility, middle, and moneyed men called on the poor to help. Together, We lopped off that top branch of tyranny, but the tree still stands and spreads. New branches hide the sun of freedom from the poor. The Revolutionary Tribunal is one such. I don't recognize its authority to judge me. Only the poor of St. Nicholas can do that. I come here to lay the rags and tatters of my life before my peers. Habits are hard to break, citizens. I come to confess me. Hear my confession. Do not forgive me, Father, for I have not sinned. My own father had 12 children, and as I was the cleverest, he rid himself of me by sending me to school at the Angoulême Seminary. At 15, I was ordained a priest, when I knew even less about God than I know now. There was a priest on every dunghill. The scummier they were, the more they sprouted. But I stayed on and became professor of philosophy, teaching students to bear with fortitude the misfortunes of others. Like religion, philosophy solves the problems of the past and the future, never the present. In 79, the Angoulême students rioted over the agony they saw around them and killed a cook by accident. As a suspect teacher with ideas, I was arrested and imprisoned, though I had nothing to do with the incident. A month or so later, I was released. No trial, no inquiry. Authority had decreed it, and I had no say in the matter whether I was to be free or in chains. This is how fires are kindled. Afterwards, I spent 4 years in the chair of experimental medicine in Angoulême, but medicine proved equally useless. Physicians know even less than philosophers and priests gangrene together. They lie. They all lie. Isn't that so, Georges? You tell them. I've grown hoarse in the telling. In 89, I was given this poor parish of St. Nicholas, and I was born into the real world of starvation and misery, and I saw the horror and the hope, too, for the revolution burst over us. Smashed the clamps that held us down and swept us up, up with its transforming power. We opened a book we'd never read, and on the first page was the word liberty. Listen. Listen. The revolution was born in violence. Revolutions must be violent. It is the only way to end the greater violence that keeps the majority of mankind in servitude. Do you think that those with privileges would give them up without a fight because you have a charming smile and the best arguments? Adjuro. Adjuro. I renounced my alliance to Rome and gave it to France. I became a constitutional priest, put off the mitred robes of privilege and put on the white robes of liberty. I still practice as a priest and physician when called upon, but I have to earn an honest living as a pamphleteer and municipal official. I live with a good woman, Widow Pettit, born Elizabeth Hubert, once laundress to the rich, now my helpmate, soulmate, who sells my pamphlets, 2 sous a copy. We adopted a son, Emile, a sweet, sweet boy. No more of that. It's not for your ears, or yours, or yours. My only fear, citizens, is not death, but a life without them. Georges knows. We love them, don't we, Georges, eh? I was elected a member of the commune and spoke for the poor. I told Robespierre, Saint-Just, Brissot, and the rest that they could never be the revolution, just men, and not to be trusted with power. Anyone with authority becomes an oppressor, a parasitic coat of filth on the hide of the common people. Between those who command and those who obey, there is only hate. Does it follow that I reject all authority? No, but I always keep my hat on in its presence. In the matter of bread, I consult a baker. In a matter of boots, a bootmaker. A house, a builder. For special knowledge, I apply to a specialist. But I don't allow the baker, the bootmaker, or the builder to impose their authority over me. I listen to them with the respect they merit, if any, but I keep the right to judge, criticize, and censure. Why should we treat politicians of whatever stripe, royal or revolutionary, any different? I listen to King Louis, Mirabeau, Lafayette the same way I listen to the baker and the bootmaker. Don't be fooled by those who set themselves above you. Always look at the bill they are presenting. You have to pay it. And criticize me too. People thought Citizen Mara and I were enemies because we were forever attacking each other. He called me an extremist, this from a man who declared 300,000 heads weren't enough. But we were never enemies, just revolutionaries doing our duty. Neither of us were popular with the legislators, but it is not my purpose to be popular. I am here to sting. To stop me stinging, the assembly hired me to write the report of the king's execution. We didn't do that well, but you'll not squeeze one tear from my eye over the fate of a royal fool and his followers who talked of honor and died without it. To the boneyard with the whole crew. The rich we'll gobble up, tra-lee, tra-la, tra-lie, with truffles in the rump and oysters on each eye. I love the harp. That's how men and women should die. To the sound of harps, they're so precious. King Louis died to the sound of drums. As the recording officer, I went with Citizen Santerre to the temple prison to escort the king to the place of execution. Santerre brought a carriage and a guard of honor for the occasion. We drove through streets lined with citizens. They had three executioners waiting, three, and 18 drummers. What extravagance just to kill one man. The knife fell, Louis's head fell with it, the crowd shouted, "Long live the Republic," and then I saw Citizen Santerre and the other revolutionary officials dipping their handkerchiefs in the king's blood. I wrote it all up in my report, but I was the only one who seemed disgusted by the whole spectacle. Invading armies were about to overwhelm Paris. There was civil strife in the Vendée, rebellions in Lyon and Bordeaux, and good men and women were dying everywhere defending the revolution. Even as this traitorous Louis was dying on the scaffold. But the good and the true had no carriages, no 18 drummers and three executioners. A Prussian sword in the belly, an English bullet in the chest, and falling face down in the mud was their end. That's how ordinary people die. Meanly. Without harps or even drums to play them out. But Louis, that useless toe rag of a man, goes in style. His anemic blood gathered up as something precious. A month later, remember, I led the attack on the Paris food merchants. I'm proud of that attack. Those in power condemn me for it, so I know it must have been right. We ask only for food, a home, a little ease, no more crying in the streets, bread, bread, for God's sake. We were at war, and so we accepted such hardships if they were equally shared, but they weren't. We were dying because of filthy bourgeois graft and greed. The slimy, rapacious, money-mad exploiters were hoarding food to raise the price on the open market. Our legislators wrung their hands, threatened with a whisper, and did nothing. So we flat bellies marched, smashed stalls, broke open shops and warehouses, and found the bread and meat and other foodstuffs they'd hidden in abundance. And they asked us why we did it. We told them because we needed it. Citizen Mara said we should kill every merchant in sight. We may do with a few scores strung up in front of their shops to encourage the others. And it did. The next morning, the food markets were filled again. The fruit and vegetables, bread and meat. Like Jesus, we had performed a miracle of the loaves and fishes. We must appropriate the land and money from the rich who have it in excess and give it to those who need it and live in want. The only way to defend and save the revolution is by pushing it as far as it'll go and then further. And that's never far enough for me. Then Citizen Mara died. Steel through the heart. Painless when he had such a painful life. I miss him. No one left to trust. That's why I agreed to become editor of his paper when his staff asked me to keep the bright flame burning. So when those impotent excremental conformists, Robespierre and the Jacobin gang, banned women from public power, from political power, we took up the cause. They wanted liberty for themselves alone. I wrote that those refugees from the leper house of reaction should be belled and booted headfirst into the nearest sewer. In return, they persuaded Mara's widow Catherine to denounce me to the Revolutionary Tribunal for besmirching her husband's memory. Poor sweet Catherine. Grief takes many forms. She wanted to protect her husband's fame. She thought I was trying to take it from him in some way. I shun fame. It always costs too much. Late last night, I went walking through the streets of Paris with Georges. Just the two of us. Georges padding beside me, sniffing every post and doorway, and me smoking my pipe. There's nothing better. making love, perhaps. Or making a revolution. But with a revolution, you have to be right. It was a clear night. Empty streets, and as we passed St. Nicholas Church, something strange happened. I was walking, but suddenly I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Not one. Silence. I was a dead man walking. No more of that. Tomorrow, before the tribunal of mumblers, I shall make no attempt to defend myself. That doesn't mean I'll stay silent. Never that. I'll do what I was born to do. Attack. If the verdict of that bunch of rotting fish heads goes against me, I'd die like friend Mara, though struck down by a better hand. My own. It's been a rich confession after all, friends, deserving of some penance, at least 5 Hail Marys and 26 Amens. After all, I've preached revolution and sedition, slaughtered a king and others, lived in sin, and will probably end even deeper in it by killing myself. In the eyes of the church, it is a 100% record of failure. But on Judgment Day, I expect to stand before my God justified. I do not condemn myself and shall not be condemned. And so, amen. If it's to be the last amen, I go gladly. My wife and son will weep, I know. And George here will howl a little, won't you, boy? My friends will pause, shake their heads, and move on. For they have the difficult part. Living well is so much harder than dying well. I have tried to help create a people who are skeptical, rational, critical, not easily fooled or impressed, in a word, a free people, ungovernable. It's a dream, of course, but I have been lucky enough to have lived through times that made the dream seem possible, and just for a moment we stop being me and mine, you and yours, us and them, and saw ourselves instead as equals in our common humanity. We are of that generation that so transformed the world that future days and nights can never be the same. We poor, clumsy men and women turned the world upside down, inside out, round and about. One last word from my last sermon. The revolution isn't complete. Hardly begun. Defend it. Don't sit back. Act. Without action, no life. Without life, no perfection. Without perfection, no eternal peace and freedom. For God is an active power. And we do his work in fighting the great battles. Light against darkness. Love against selfishness. Revolution against reaction. Life against death. Come on, George. Time for a walk.
Silas bound in jail, had no money for to go the bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. Paul and Silas thought they was lost. Dungeon shook and the chains come off. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. Name is mighty sweet, and soon we're gonna meet. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. I got my hand on the gun. gospel plow. Won't take nothing for my journey now. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on.
Greetings, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. You're listening to Back in the USSR. Once again, I am Siegfried. And if you're wondering what that was, that performance at the beginning of the show, that was me performing Peter Barnes' one-act play entitled The Preacher, about Jacques Roux, one of the most radical political leaders in the days of the French Revolution. And of course, at the beginning of the program, we had Billy Bragg with The Red Flag. Communist song originally written by James Connolly, the Irish revolutionary. And I performed that one-act play for a very important reason, that Peter Barnes play, The Preacher. I performed that for a very important reason that has to do with culture, specifically about the struggle for culture in modern capitalist society, where the big media conglomerates own most outlets of creative expression and heavily influence the books, plays, movies, TV shows, web content, etc., that we consume. And as such, control the lion's share of the images that we put in our heads and the lenses with which we view the world around us. As Michael Parenti's talked about, and I've played his talks about this before on the show, the mainstream media absolutely has its own agenda and its own interests, and those interests are very much class interests. Specifically, the media reinforces the status quo and buttresses the control of the present ruling class, the ruling capitalist class. Whether it's cheering on the latest overseas war against some, quote, rogue state, trying to justify or downplay police brutality and murder of black people, or smear leftist anti-fascists as being somehow just as bad, if not worse, than the diehard Nazis they've been successfully fighting in the streets of Charlottesville and other North American cities, which I talked about last week. As Michael Parenti writes, quote, media bias usually does not occur in random fashion. Rather, it moves in more or less consistent directions, favoring management over labor, corporations over corporate critics, affluent whites over low-income minorities, officialdom over protesters, privatization and free market reforms over public sector development, U.S. domination of the Third World over revolutionary or populist social change, and conservative commentators and columnists over progressive and radical ones. So the media serves capitalist interests. And it's important to emphasize that these biases don't just apply to the news media. Entertainment media and popular culture is also overflowing with these same biases, which are mass marketed and which systematically try to push out competing viewpoints. And this includes literature, where massive corporate-owned publishing houses dominate the market and decide which authors get promoted and which ones languish on the back shelves, or whose books never even get published or see the light of day. The same thing goes for radio and television. So pushing back against capitalist control of culture is not an easy thing. Radical viewpoints rarely get a hearing, let alone a fair hearing, in today's society. And one of the reasons I created this show in the first place, why I created Back in the USSR in the first place, was to push back in some small way against this control. And I'm also a writer. And the genre of literature that I write in, it has to be said, is historically one of the most conservative. You see, I write fantasy short stories, and I'm currently working on a novel, which I'll talk a little bit about more later. But first, I want to say a few things about the fantasy genre in particular, and I think it says a lot about the kind of challenges that, say, more radical writers, you could say, are up against, more progressive writers. Even if they're writing fiction. Because the fantasy genre really was created in the 19th century as a backlash against industrialization. With politically conservative writers condemning the radical changes happening to European society and really romanticizing traditional fairy stories, folk tales, and really idealizing the Middle Ages. And the kind of life that existed before factories and urbanization and all that kind of stuff. Back when the feudal aristocracy and the church controlled everyone's life, and there was no such thing as modern medicine, sanitation, or education, and people were dropping dead of plague left and right. They really thought it was a keen time to be alive. These conservative writers in the 19th century who really invented fantasy. And, you know, they started writing all this stuff about knights and damsels in distress and lost kings and Old Norse gods and prophecies and all this sort of stuff, coming up with grandiose mythologies of their own. That really was the genesis of fantasy in the 19th century. It was a backlash, basically, a conservative backlash against the industrialization and modern society that it was producing, and like in which the common people were pushing for more and more changes, reforms, and even revolutionary changes, increasingly in the 19th and 20th centuries. Fantasy was almost a backlash against all that. And it really portrayed this kind of really romanticized view of the past, basically. Really idealized view of the past. And this is the genre that ultimately in the 1950s produced J.R.R. Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings, which is a profoundly conservative series of books. I mean, profoundly conservative. Frodo Baggins and his boys are engaged in a classic conservative quest to, like, really a classically conservative quest to rescue the status quo from threatening outside forces, some of whom, like the evil Suthrons, have dark skin and are specifically labeled swarthy men, in contrast with the heroic Edain peoples of Gondor, who are basically white Europeans. You know, and they're the good guys. They're portrayed as the good guys. The conservative quest to rescue the status quo from threatening outside forces, put the rightful king on the throne, and restore the glory days of the past, effectively. You know, that's what happens in Lord of the Rings. Tolkien himself, interestingly enough, was a conservative Catholic who was absolutely enraged when the Latin Mass was scrapped by the church hierarchy during all the reforms that happened in the early 1960s, you know, with Vatican II and all the changes that happened in the Catholic Church around that time. He was enraged by that, you know, like he was a real traditionalist in a lot of ways, and definitely, you know, had a very conservative message in his books. You know, certainly not, you know, one that glorifies the common people, like, or has them, you know, really engage in action for themselves, or like changing society, like to better themselves or better their condition or any of that. Like, that doesn't happen in Lord of the Rings. And while in recent years the conventions of fantasy have been challenged somewhat, it remains essentially politically conservative. I mean, George R. R. Martin might not exactly idealize feudalism per se in his Game of Thrones novels, and his aristocrats are certainly not heroic or praiseworthy people in many cases, but he certainly provides no alternatives to feudalism and the kind of political, socioeconomic society that exists in his books. I mean, his peasants, laborers, prostitutes, townsfolk, and slaves certainly don't rise up and fight for something better. Even though their land of Westeros is getting absolutely destroyed, torn to shreds by aristocratic rivalries, which are most certainly not in the interest of ordinary people and which destroy the lives of countless thousands, you know, he still presents the commoners as essentially passive people. Like, they don't do anything for themselves. They're just led this way and that by different aristocrats, you know, like these different masters, basically. They don't organize themselves. They don't like fight for like their own interests. They don't do any of that kind of stuff. They don't have any, they really don't have any agency of their own. And they can only really wait for some aristocratic savior to come along, some good aristocrat to come and save them and restore peace and order. It's a very conservative picture, and one that is not at all in line with the actual history of medieval Europe, which was full of peasant revolts, urban uprisings, slave rebellions, labor strikes, and class struggles of all kinds. You know, I say that because George R. R. Martin, one of the things he often says is he, like, takes a lot of his inspiration from history. And obviously there's whole swaths of history he's ignoring when he writes these books. And he's obviously being very selective about what he takes out of history and puts in these books. I mean, to quote Michael Parenti's History is Mystery, quote, "Over the centuries, sporadic peasant uprisings against insufferable conditions, assumed such scope and fury as to send tremors throughout aristocratic Europe during the Middle Ages. The year 579 saw a major peasant insurrection against the Merovingian king in France because of tax burdens. Serious revolts occurred in 841 and 843 against feudal rule in Saxony. Peasant rebellions in 13th century northern and central Europe shook Drenthe, West and East Frisia, Dithmarschen, and especially Stedingerland from 1207 to 1234. In Germany, there were four major upheavals in the 1300s and 40 in the 1400s. Nor should we forget the Jacquerie of 1358 in France, the massive peasant insurrections throughout England in 1381 and in Flanders between 1323 and 1328, the Hussite Rebellion in Bohemia in the early 15th century, the peasant wars in Germany during the Reformation, and the revolts of the French townships in the early 1600s. Even this incomplete list belies the image of a placid, rustic multitude living in mutually serviceable relations with their lords and bishops. End quote. So that's Michael Parenti talking about how the history of the Middle Ages is a very radical time. You know, it was not like a time of peace or like this pastoral idealized image that a lot of early fantasy writers and even modern fantasy writers put out there, like almost like looking upon it as a time of peace and harmony and where everybody knew their place. And, it's kind of like, and they idealize it. Like, there was nothing to idealize about feudal Europe. I mean, it was a terrible place, a terribly oppressive place, and people fought back against that oppression. Constantly, all the time. Like, it was a time, like, of constant class struggle, like, in feudal Europe. I mean, it was not, these myths of that being a time of harmony are, like, just nonsense. But, of course, if you read something like George R.R. Martin, you would not know that. If you read Game of Thrones, if you read like a lot of fantasy novels, you will not know that. When I started writing my first novel, fantasy novel, in the fall of 2016, I wanted really to stand this genre, this situation on its head. So the main characters in the novel are working class or oppressed people. They're not fighting to restore some idealized past or restore some lost king to the throne. Instead, they're actively fighting against the oppression they face in their society. At first, simply for survival, just out of survival. But later, they began fighting to create a whole new order of things. A society without princes, aristocrats, serfdom, or slavery. And seeing most modern societies abolish these things ages ago, I don't think writing a book like this is all that radical. But in the context of the fantasy genre, which still has its head stuck in the Middle Ages, it's very radical indeed to be talking about, like, abolishing things like slavery or abolishing serfdom or, like, overthrowing a king and creating a republic. That's very radical to bring that kind of stuff into fantasy because it's such a conservative genre and historically has been. Right now, I'd like to read the prologue of my novel, and then I'll take a short break. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. This is the prologue to my book. It's called, the book is actually entitled Foulhorn, and this prologue is just titled Of Beginnings. So I'll just read this here. Every worthwhile tale begins in obscurity. I, for one, do not hail from the palaces of kings, nor was I born to gilded heritage amid the banquet halls of the nobility. I am neither high-born, nor does the sanguine blood of refinement run through my coarse veins. On the contrary, it was my fate to be born into servitude. As the running dog of such people for whom the accident of birth makes them think that they can beat a serving boy to within an inch of his life if he should dare to be late serving them their choice cuts of meat at dinner or carrying away their piss from the bedchamber each morning. It was likewise their civilized attitudes that condemned a spirited young boy to a life in chains, subjected to the murderous discipline of the whip and the equally murderous caprices of the overseer who wields it over his chattel in the fields. The order is no more. If I am a knight, then it is because I learned at a young age the true meaning of life. That it is a weapon to be sacrificed upon the altar of battle in the pursuit of one's chosen aims. Aims that you must be ready to die for. I was given no choice but to learn this truth. And now I understand that whether one dies peacefully and contented in a sick bed, or lashed into a bloody pulp on some forsaken plantation slave pen, or as a corpse on the battlefield pierced by a dozen lances and fed on by ravens, it will always end in blood. For even the one who dies peacefully only gains that privilege by climbing into his sickbed over the bodies of others who have died meanly, so that he may breathe his last in blissful tranquility. And I spit on such cowards, and I have no intention of having others do my fighting for me. For the purposeful man, the man who would keep his freedom in a world bound and chained, is always at war. And I, for one, have never had the time nor the patience to entertain the ardent lies that the complacent tell themselves. For I was born a nameless creature in a land on fire, and all that I have won by the edge of my blade. I am, and can only ever be, a weapon.
Dark are the days,
dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days, dark are the days,
dark side, dark days, wrongs lurking, task can't be shirking, jerking back and forth, working south to north and east to west, bless ocean and seas, marksman,
360 degrees,
dialectic, abstract, act and negate. I know you never found me, knock at heaven's gate. Religion and illusion, opium of the people, and just saw busters to wit equal. Insult to the news of a day dog. A child was abused, man stabbed in the park. The union's rejected, 9%. Lady Di's dress was heaven sent. We got mass confusion, therefore mass delusion. Media, a bourgeois institution.
We'll be right back.
survive. No working 9 to 5 with no job pride. Wages impractical, the boss Mr. Mister. Turn like a slave for you ever since dismissed ya. Doctor, doctor, you clean up and slop ya. Suck up to the blues roar and then they sap ya. Power struggles run amok and we bear the brunt. But marksman punt to stun bourgeois grunts. We past leading present, the future consequential. Reform fundamental, we've all potential. West implanted, East now supplanted. Sorry you're the selfish ones that ranted. But the marks bar lit the flame in the heart. And now the West ways are dark. Dark are the days.
Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days.
Dark side.
Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days.
Dark side.
Days are dark. Watch me as the spark plugs bust and his first cuss is the hardness. Hark to the poet, the one that entertains. Even if I blow it, marksman remains. Cock the doo doo doo, son, all this has begun. Run a little lyrical, some concoction. Little put a break on the man. He's got a system, but the system's out of hand. Overproduction of food is a crime. When there's mass starvation, a nation is dying. How can you justify stand up and decry the communist when you stand for all this? Persist in your madness and be damned as the tables turn to a clenched hand.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back with this short break. Please stay tuned to CFRU.
If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach at cfru.ca for more information.
Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on CFRU 93.3.
Radio for the young and the young at heart.
It's a kids' show, ding dong!
If you or anyone close to you is experiencing distress, depression, substance issues, or any mental health challenges right now, please know that Connect's Ontario helplines are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, staffed by information and referral specialists who can help. The toll-free number is 1-866-531-2600. That's 1-866-531-2600. You can also chat online or email specialists via the website mentalhealthhelpline.ca. These services are available to those in distress as well as family and friends concerned about someone close to them. The toll-free number once more is 1-866-531-2600. This message is brought to you by Connects Ontario Helplines and CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph's community radio station.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and I realize I actually didn't introduce one of the songs I played just after I actually did Peter Barnes' one-act play, performed that earlier in the broadcast, I didn't actually introduce Bruce Springsteen's version of Eyes on the Prize, which actually is a Pete Seeger song. But when Bruce Springsteen did a whole album called The Seeger Sessions, where he just did like all these songs, folk songs, many of them rebel songs for that matter, like that surrounding class struggle in America that Pete Seeger did in the earlier in the 20th century. I just thought like that recording was just incredible, so I had to include that on tonight's program. But we heard from Billy Bragg, The Red Flag. We heard Bruce Springsteen, Eyes on the Prize. We had Mark's Man, Dark of the Days, which is the one I just played there. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play Lee Reed, Bazooka Rap. And then we're going to get into Michael Parenti's talk, which I actually mentioned earlier, and I have played this before. This is his talk, Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. This is where he's talking about how class, the class control of the entertainment media in particular. Like, so I talked about how a few publishing conglomerates really control the publishing industry, you know, and who gets access to that and whatnot. And it's the same thing, of course, like for the entertainment media, like, you know, who controls Hollywood, who controls like the big, you know, cartels that do that, produce movies and like what content gets into those movies and this sort of stuff. Like obviously that there's a major class control component there, just like there is in the news media. But of course, as he says at the beginning of this talk, one of the things that's really important is like the to remember is that the entertainment media is important because it consumes much more of a percentage of the viewing time that most Americans and certainly most Canadians spend on. I mean, there are definitely, you know, people are consuming a lot more entertainment media than they are watching the news. So this is really what he focuses on, and it's really a brilliant talk. It's probably one of my favorites that he gives. So, and that really gets into a lot of what I talked about earlier, really elaborates on it. So that's really what I want to play right now. So without further ado, I will play first Lee Reed, his song Bazooka Rap, and then we'll get into Michael Parenti. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Flow combat, be I born that, beaches thorn that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle maps at top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists clap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer, I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, give back like church hats or get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big dog, teach you the flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on that all shit, pump your fist if you know where we are, that's a rap, boom bap, original rap at, take it to back, boom bap, boom bap, I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math, boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap, original rap. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. The talk we're about to hear by Dr. Michael Parenti is titled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. Michael Parenti is an author and political analyst. Among his books are The Sword and the Dollar, Inventing Reality, History is Mystery, and his latest, The Terrorism Trap. This talk was given in 1989 in North Hollywood, California, during the administration of George Bush I, an administration consisting of most of the same players that occupy positions in the present Bush administration. In the talk, Parenti looks at the entertainment media as a